Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. During an interview on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown accuses President Trump of being racist.
Well, I think this country hasn't dealt well with the issues of race. I mean, we have a president who's a racist.
You believe in his heart he's a racist?
Well, I don't know what in his heart means. I know that he built his political career knowing what he was doing on questioning the legitimacy and the birthplace of the president of the United States.
We're talking about that and more today on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Dayton Daily News Government reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs reporter Marty Schladen. I say welcome back. It's not your first time on All Sides, but it is your first time as part of the roundtable. Welcome.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
And Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Okay, Brown criticized Trump after the president. These remarks about Trump came up after Trump had called for Virginia Governor Ralph Northam to resign following the revelations of that Northam may have been photographed in either blackface or Ku Klux Klan outfit, or at least had a picture of such posted on his page in his yearbook as a medical student. What about this strategy? Because it's not the first time Brown has questioned the president's racist pedigree, such as it is. So what do you think, Marty Schladen? What about this right in his face, right off the bat?
Well, one possible cynical interpretation is that he's trying to get access to Donald Trump's Twitter feed, as you were saying before we came on air. And I think also he's trying to position himself as somebody who's ready to fight Trump and Trump country and, you know, go right at, you know, where he thinks Trump might have a weakness.
Hmm. Laura Bischoff.
I agree with Marty that I think that Sherrod Brown is wants to position himself as somebody who's going to, you know, call it as he sees it. And he is in the middle of his Dignity of Work tour. Mm-hmm. He's, kicked it off in Cleveland last week, went to Iowa. I think he's slated to go to New Hampshire.
He's following the polar vortex. Yeah.
The polar vortex, also known as the presidential primary states. he's gotten some really good news coverage leading up to that tour and into the tour. And I think that he's looking to kind of vault it up further with engaging Trump in a fight.
Andy Chow?
I would say that this is definitely on brand for Sherrod Brown. I think the thing that he's been doing ever since 2016 when Trump was elected was sort of take a little from each pot. So he would drop a little bit of information about how he aligns with Trump when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to trade deals, when it comes to getting tough on China. But then just as he's sort of softening himself for pro-Trump people, he takes a big swing at Trump on other things like immigration issues and more of the other social issues, these things that really progressives are upset about, especially when it comes to the anti-immigration rhetoric, the anti-LGBTQ rhetoric, and the racist rhetoric.
Could it backfire, though, coming out like this on something like Meet the Press with Trump's supporters?
I think that's what you get when you kind of play hot and cold for the same people, because I think, you know, as we're seeing as he's going through Iowa, he is trying to connect with people who might identify themselves as pro-Trump voters. And he's trying to identify with them on the issues, but then separate himself on the rhetoric. So I think it is a tough game to play. I don't know if it's going to work out, but it seems to be his strategy at this point.
I don't think that the Trump voters are going to be voting in the Democratic primary anyway. I think he's on safe ground to criticize the president. It actually probably, you know, will endear him to a lot of the Democratic voters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think he also has to establish himself as someone who can win in the general election. And I do wonder, because of what happened in the 2016 primary with the Democrats, if the Democrats voting in the primary are thinking more about that now than they did in the past.
And I think that's definitely Brown's lane. His argument is he can win the Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, places where, you know, Trump really made the difference for Trump when he won.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. I know you guys don't cover Virginia, but you cover Ohio, and so you kind of get that statewide political dynamic. He's digging in. The governor of Virginia is digging in. These aren't allegations. This is a fact that there's an extremely racist photograph on his, I keep wanting to say Facebook page, on his yearbook page from when he graduated from medical school. Laura Bischoff?
Right. This was in the mid-80s. I didn't realize that medical schools had yearbooks, but apparently they do in Virginia.
And they get their own, you get your own page.
And you get your own page. And yeah, I was, when I saw the photo, I was like, oh my God, that was really shocking. And what was interesting is that he acknowledged that he was in the photo. He didn't say whether he was the guy in blackface or the guy in the KKK outfit. So initially on Friday, he acknowledged that he was in the picture. And then on Saturday, he walked it back and denied it. And now he's, even though there's all these widespread calls for his resignation within Virginia and really across the nation, he's, as of this moment, holding on.
Yeah.
And whether he's in it or not, and I think this has been discussed at length, but whether he's in it or not, it was on his page. He's had decades to say, I don't want that on my page, or I didn't like that when that happened. I mean, it seemed to be on his page without any debate from him.
And he's kind of shown that he doesn't get the severity of this in other ways. He has confessed to wearing blackface to do a Michael Jackson imitation. He apparently was ready to do the moonwalk with reporters during the current scandal until his wife suggested or put a stop to it. So it seems as if he doesn't really get how just offensive this all is.
Also bringing to light something that I think people have noticed the past couple of years. When it comes to scandals related to racial or racist issues, if it involves somebody in the private sector, people call for their jobs and they lose their jobs instantly. I mean, I'm thinking about that meteorologist who made a comment when he was talking about Martin Luther King. And he was fired almost instantly. But then there's all this outrage when it comes to politicians and people in government. Why aren't they held to the same standard?
Because they're elected to office, though. There's a different boss.
Exactly. And so there's a question of those people seem to be more hesitant to step down, maybe because they are held to a different standard. Maybe they want to let the voters decide whether they should stay or go. But it just seems like things move slower when it comes to these types of scandals if it involves a government official.
You know, what's interesting is the Republicans are kind of not calling out Donald Trump when his rhetoric crosses the line. And I think that the Democrats are trying to do a better job of policing their own. Mm. That's why you hear folks like Sherrod Brown saying he should
all over the place,
right.
Because it could create a drag for the Democratic brand come 2020.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Northam's win in Virginia was a big milestone for the Democrats. It was an off-year election, and they captured like 15 seats in the House of Delegates in Virginia, and the Democrats are, I think, like 2 seats away from controlling both chambers. And so it really positioned the Democrats for a resurgence in Virginia with Northam at the head of that. And so this is a big problem for the Virginia Democrats.
I think it's got to be really dispiriting for them because this is one of the first big elections after Trump got elected in 16. And, I think they felt like part of it was a changing Virginia as it becomes more suburban, more people move to the D.C. area. But also I think they thought it was a repudiation of Trump and some of the racially charged things he says. And now here's their guy. And I don't know that Trump's ever done anything half as bad as this.
Well, not blatantly, but
not half
certainly
as blatant,
on
right.
The bus trip with the Bush guy from
Billy Bush and the Access Hollywood tape.
I mean,
right.
I mean, I guess it just depends, you know, but it's kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, Laura's right. When you do hear the Democrats being as vocal as they are about Northam stepping down, it does seem to be them walking the walk when they talk about how you have so many well-respected traditional Republicans and conservatives in Congress who seem to back away and not call out Trump for the things that he does. And so I do think the Democrats see this as a big signal of, oh, we've been wanting the Republicans to do this for a while now. It's our turn to do this. And I think that's why you're definitely hearing a big outcry.
Getting back to Sherrod Brown, he's on this Dignity of Work tour. It's supposed to be sort of a preamble to him making a decision about running for president in 2020. Any sense about how he's doing? Are any of you guys following this?
Yeah, it seems like he's been having different town hall meetings and different panel discussions and forums. And I think I saw last night or the night before, he had one of his bigger events. And so it seems like he might be gaining a bigger following. We tend to be cynical and say, oh, well, you know, he's definitely running. He's just, this is his exploratory committee. But I do think that this is him really trying to figure out if his main message, this dignity of work message, can work. And if he thinks it really can gain traction in a place like Iowa, then I think that is, and New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, then I think that this really will inform him on whether he's going to run or not. You know, you see Kamala Harris and other people getting into the race, and they've been laying out their messages. And it doesn't really seem like anyone has the kind of message that Sherrod Brown wants to bring to the table. So I think you are seeing it pick up a little bit. I've been reading how he's been talking to farmers and his stance on trade when it comes to how it impacts the manufacturing industry sort of impacts farmers in a different way. So he's been trying to sort of toe the line on what's good for manufacturing is also good for farmers and vice versa. So he's sort of seems like he's sussing that out.
You know, he wants to portray himself as this dignity of work worker advocate. He's a progressive on a lot of things. He wants fair trade. I think the downside for Sherrod Brown is that he's a white male in his 60s. And, you know, the Democrats have not won the White House with a white guy since the 90s. It's a much more diverse party these days. And so that could work against him. NPR, I think it was NPR, had a little class chart of who's running, who might run, who's thinking about running, who's already said they're not running.
The most diverse in history.
It's very diverse. And it's also really handy. It's almost like a Russian novel. You got to try and keep all these characters straight. And you need the chart at the front of the book so you can keep referring back to it.
We are talking politics and public policy today. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard Laura Bischoff, state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Also, Andy Chow, Wahio Public Radio, and Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from listeners. You can give at WOSU.org. Support also comes from Middle West Spirits, raising a glass to life in the Middle West with their Ohio vodkas, Vim and Petal Gin, or Middle West whiskeys. Details at MiddleWestSpirits.com.
Wow. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable still with us. Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen, and Dayton Daily News government reporter Laura Bischoff. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. The new Speaker of the Ohio House of Representatives, Larry Householder, a Republican, had a Q&A on Friday. It was his first big Q&A, right, Laura Bischoff?
Yes. He met with the State House Press Corps and talked with us for a good hour.
In his office.
Right. And he covered a lot of ground. You know, we talked about the gas tax, abortion bills, guns, you know, K-12 funding.
Medicaid expansion, energy regulation, charter schools.
Yeah, so we can dig into any of that.
Yeah, and but just in general, before we dig into some of that, because I want to get to it, what was your sense about the tenor of the Q&A?
So to just give a little background, usually by this point, we would have had a speaker and leadership, caucus leadership, and at this point they would have rolled out their agenda, maybe their top 10 bills and their priorities. And so for the past couple of weeks, because as listeners may know, there is a big speaker fight where Larry Householder was able to gain the speakership by winning over half of his voters were from the Democrats. So there's just this big speaker fight. So for the past couple of weeks, we really haven't even known what the agenda is, what the priorities are. So when he walked in, he was very folksy about things, kind of gave this attitude that he's an open book, and he laid out where the caucus wanted to go on a lot of these issues.
It kind of reminded me of Vern Reif a little bit when I read about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's from Perry County and
Southern Ohio.
You know, he served as a speaker from 2001 to 2004, and there was a big he was forced out by term limits. But at the same time, the Department of Justice had an open investigation on him. There were allegations of pay-to-play politics. In 2006, the DOJ announced that the investigation was closed. There would be no charges, and I think Householder has been probably, you know, planning his comeback ever since. I think he feels vindicated that there were no charges. He says there was nothing, you know, there was no there. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it was interesting to see him return to the House in 2017 with clear plans that he was going to get the Speaker's gavel back again.
Well,
how surprising was that to you guys that actually came about? Yeah.
I wasn't surprised at all. You don't count out Larry Householder.
Right. He's knowing Larry Householder, right?
Yeah, he's very folksy. He's very smart. He's extremely hardworking. He raises a lot of money, and he knows, you know, how to get things done.
I think it was also, I think the surprising thing is that it was surprising to some people in the House. So you had the traditional Republicans, traditional conservatives. In the majority caucus who wanted Ryan Smith. And I think everybody sort of thought that it was going to be the status quo for him to come in and be speaker, even though he didn't have the popular majority. But then at that point, that's when Householder started trying to win over the Democrats. And I think there were a handful of Democrats, about a dozen of them, who thought there's no way that we would, you know, draw a line in the sand and actually play a huge role in this. And then in the end, they did. 26 Democrats and 26 Republicans voted for Householder.
And they're saying, Jim Siegel of the Dispatch wrote last week about how Ohio Democrats in the House like what they see as bipartisan cooperation in the Ohio House. They say it's off to a good start, Marty.
Yeah, it seems as if of course, you know, this is before, you know, anybody has
this
gotten
is very early in the process.
Yeah,
still.
Early days. Nobody's gotten in a big fight yet. So everybody's saying nice things about one another. But it does seem to me, and I'm a relative outsider to all of this, it does seem to me that there is an appetite for some bipartisan action on some big issues, you know, school funding, you know, that sort of thing.
I think part of his sales pitch, which is something that Householder said on Friday, is that it's going to be a more bipartisan process. So they're changing different rules here and there. I mean, this gets into the weeds, but when you go to a committee meeting, if a Democrat wants to offer an amendment, it's immediately tabled without having a discussion on it. Mm-hmm. It's been a fairly usual process for the past five or six years. He wants to do away with that to have more discussion on the amendment. So there's definitely a push towards making the process more bipartisan. But I think what we're going to discover in the next 2 years is that the process might be bipartisan, but I think we're still going to see controversial bills like the heartbeat bill. He said mm-hmm. that he does want to see the heartbeat bill go through. He wants to make changes to Medicaid expansion. There are things that Democrats are going to be upset about, and I wonder if they're going to be happy with
Here's a prediction. Those committee meetings are going to last longer. They're not going to table the amendments, so they're going to have a discussion on all of them. And they're going to have cameras, web cameras, kind of like what
they
we have
are going to be doing that finally.
Right. So there's more
for
transparency,
sure.
But it means
it has a timeline and everything.
Right. Okay. But that means that there's going to be, you know, an incentive to, you know, play up to the cameras and fully discuss your ideas. I mean, which is fine. You know, that's
yeah.
good.
It's going to take longer.
It's going to take longer. That's my prediction.
And,
it'll take
and
longer.
I do think that part of the consternation from Democrats is that they knew that they were going up against a supermajority in the House. All they wanted was their time to talk about the issue, to debate the issue. There is a moment where I think it's Representative Stephanie House was gaveled down when she wanted to talk about a gun issue.
I think it was the Stand Your Ground.
Yeah, it was Stand Your Ground on the House floor. She was gaveled down. And
by Ryan Smith.
By Ryan Smith, huh. Who, you know, lost her vote. So I think there's this issue of course, that bill was going to pass. It ended up being a self-defense bill. Of course, that bill was going to pass. I think the Democrats just wanted their time to speak their piece on the issue. And I think they think with Larry Householder, they're going to get that.
And Smith got really angry, it seemed to me, in that moment. And that probably was a difficult thing for the Democrats. But did that fracture their caucus? Because we'd speculated in the newsroom that if the Democrats had hung tough, you know, and not voted for either Republican, they might have actually burnished their position.
I think that within the Democratic caucus, you know, Fred Strayhorn from Dayton has been the minority leader. Mm-hmm. He stood beside Ryan Smith. Amelia Sykes, who is the incoming new minority leader, went for Householder. And I think some of the fracture was that they didn't feel like Ryan Smith was really, you know, getting them anything different, and that Householder was offering more bipartisanship, more transparency, and so they, you know, they broke for him. It was interesting. I thought maybe the Democrats, had they hung together as a block of 38, they probably could have maybe fashioned a more true power-sharing agreement.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the things that Larry Householder has said, because as far as the funding structure for charter schools, he's saying that he would support a system of making them all nonprofit in Ohio. That's pretty radical.
Right. He was talking about the management companies that the charter schools like pay, you know, lease buildings and pay for services. Some of those are for profit, and he wants it to be nonprofit. Although when asked, I think, by Andy if it would be retroactive, he said, well, I'm not really into retroactive.
And that was kind of a big question. So when Rich Cordray, the Democratic nominee for governor, was running for office, he said that he wanted to make all these charters literally nonprofit, instead of, you know, this idea of being nonprofit, but yet partnering with a for-profit managing company. Cordray was asked the same question. Well, how would you do that retroactively? How would you work on these charters? And he didn't really have an answer for that as well. I think with Householder, he was just saying, I'm not going to do that. So that would mean that these schools that are already set up with for-profit
management, they'd have kind of a monopoly
of
for-profit.
Yeah. And so it's sort of like after the fact, like, okay, these people were able to do that, but no more.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and also with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News and Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. What else did he say?
Well, I want to make sure – I kind of want to go back to something when we were talking about how Householder was able to win the speakership. Mm-hmm. Something that I think needs to be mentioned is that Householder made a lot of promises when it came to not touching labor issues. Yeah. And that played a huge role in why the Democrats voted for him because
The primary point being the right so-called right to work legislation that's out there.
There is also an issue regarding prevailing wage that's been floating out there, and I think the Democrats have a good feeling that that's not going to be touched as well. And, you know, when the speaker vote happened, a lot of representatives from labor unions and different associations were on the floor working the floor. And so I think that that played a huge role into it as well, the labor issues. I just want to make sure we mentioned that.
Yeah.
Another thing that came up in the conversation was, we kind of mentioned this earlier, was the heartbeat bill. This issue that keeps floating out there, the idea that Ohio would ban an abortion as early as 6 weeks once a fetal heartbeat is detected. Something that's interesting, at least I thought it was interesting, was this is something that constantly comes out of the House and then goes to the Senate, and then it's sort of stalled in the Senate for a while and it's sort of kicked around a little bit. Householder says he wants it to start in the Senate. And he wants the Senate to sort of start the whole issue and then send it over
Why?
To the House.
Because so that it gets done?
Yeah, I think so that it gets done.
Well,
I think it makes
– you know, the speaker said, hey, we're busy with the transportation budget and the operating budget, mm-hmm. and it's really up to the Senate to start this. I think maybe it might have been part of his deal with the Democrats, like, hey, I won't bring up heartbeat. But if it comes to our floor, you know, this is something that the Republican members definitely want to do. So, you know, I think we'll probably see it later this year.
After the budget.
Right.
Mm-hmm. After July.
The other thing he talked about was the Stand Your Ground bill. This it kind of got stripped down. And right now, you have a duty to retreat from public places if you face a threat before you could use lethal force. And if you get rid of that duty to retreat, it's called Stand Your Ground. It's sort of the colloquial name for it. And there was a bill, House Bill 228, that had that in there, and then they pulled it out at the last minute. And the governor, Kasich, didn't like the bill anyway. He ended up vetoing it. But anyway, I think the Stand Your Ground, Larry Householder said he thinks Stand Your Ground is going to come back. And I said, well, you know, John Kasich was championing a number of gun control measures. Do you see any of those coming forward? And he basically said, no. Mm-mm. So don't plan on seeing any gun control measures. More likely we'll see a continuation of expanding gun rights.
And I think that's going to be an interesting issue going forward. The big thing that Kasich wanted is the thing called the red flag law, where if somebody exhibits disturbing behavior or behavior where the person might hurt himself, herself,
or somebody else,
or others, mm-hmm. that the court could then come in and take the guns away. Mm-hmm. The concern, especially among conservatives, is that this is basically confiscating firearms without due process and giving the court the ability to do so. The Senate and Senate President Larry Obhoff and his Republican majority, they said that he's interested in looking into this issue as long as they have certain due process measures in place. The same was said by Governor Mike DeWine. He said that he would also be interested in red flag laws. So the fact that Larry Householder might not want to take up red flag laws might create an interesting dynamic.
What I think is interesting is I think that there's some people that see red flag laws as a suicide prevention measure, mm-hmm. Because it's a way if a loved one is exhibiting is in crisis and has a lot of firearms, it's a chance for family and or law enforcement to go to the court. Ask, you know, petition the court for an order to seize the weapons until the person is like through the crisis. And, you know, more than just over half of all gun deaths in Ohio are by suicide.
And that's really, really important. That's where this becomes a public health issue. I think gun deaths now in the United States exceed traffic fatalities. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, like Laura says, it's a big percentage of its suicide deaths.
And the suicide rate has been climbing across the nation and also in Ohio. I think it's up more than 30% over the last 10 years.
And whenever you talk about gun deaths, the focus tends to be on mass shootings and sort of the things that make headlines. But in the end, it's these individual-by-individual deaths by suicide.
Yeah, the latest one I read about this morning, a 4-year-old found a gun under a mattress and shot his pregnant mother in the face. Mm. by accident.
Well, and that brings up another issue that constantly comes up in the House and Senate and never moves forward is this idea of locking up guns.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that every time the legislature creates a study committee to talk about the big issues regarding gun regulations in Ohio, you know, you talk about the big headline making ones like ammunition and body piercing ammo, red flag laws, straw man purchases. But this sort of the one that doesn't make any headlines is this locking up guns. And several experts have come in and say if you require people to lock up a gun, it'll save a lot of lives.
You know, what's interesting is that it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with Governor Mike DeWine. You know, he and John Husted got the endorsement from the National Rifle Association. But at the same time, they have a very child-centered agenda, child safety, mm-hmm. Child protection. So if a gun, you know, gun locking bill were to come up, it'd be interesting to see what kind of position they take on it.
Yeah.
It looks like moving on to some other things. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine has nominated Randy Gardner to be the chancellor of Ohio's higher education system, and it looks like Randy Gardner's ship might have just come in. He'll be the highest paid
in the cabinet. He's going to make like $190,000.
He's been around a long time.
He has. I think he's the second longest serving lawmaker.
Yeah, probably.
Right. I think he said, was it Olslager? Scott Olslager?
Yeah, Scott Olslager's the longest, and they were both serving together, of course, yeah, back in the day.
And Scott Olslager, of course, he's a Republican from Canton area, and he's likely to be the House Finance Chairman.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
Right.
Again, another one, yeah, another dog has his day, I guess. But
and I think that Randy Gardner might be the only sitting lawmaker who got plucked out for an administrative job.
So far as I know.
So far, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because Dorothy Palando was
She was
a former representative who was term limited.
She's going to head agriculture.
Let's take a break and we'll come back and finish our conversation. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. We have Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining me, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Marty Schladen, you wrote about something that a lot of people ask about from time to time. Why don't we just use... you know, pick a drug that's killing people rampantly for executions in Ohio because there's a problem obtaining drugs. You wrote about that pretty extensively. It's complicated.
It is complicated, just like everything else with the death penalty. And, you know, the state's killing people. There probably are going to be complications involved with something like that. But in terms of fentanyl, a problem that the state is increasingly having, all states are, is pharmaceutical manufacturers do not want to sell their products for executions.
Because
they're producing them for a medical purpose and they don't view execution as a medical purpose, you know, quite the opposite. And they've come under a lot of pressure from anti-death penalty groups. States don't really tell manufacturers why or what purpose they want to use these drugs for.
And manufacturers are responding how to that?
Well, when they find out, they sue. Mm-hmm. in other states. I believe it was in Nebraska, or no, it was in Nevada. There was another fentanyl execution in Nebraska in August. There was an attempted one in Nevada, but the maker of another drug in the cocktail, midazolam, which is used in Ohio, they found out that their product—it was their product that Nevada was using. So they sued. The execution was postponed. The condemned man committed suicide. But the Death Penalty Information Center tells me that the drug maker prevailed in their lawsuit, which contended that basically the drug was obtained through fraudulent means.
Yeah, and I think it's as well the how fentanyl works isn't necessarily there is a cruel and unusual function here, and dying of an overdose isn't necessarily painless. It seems like a lot of people are dying fast, but it's not necessarily like that.
No, well, and actually, though, there, in that sense, you know, there's this federal litigation that's been going on in Dayton over the Ohio Death Penalty Protocol for 15 years now, it was a very big deal. The judge there has had a string of top flight medical experts testify about Ohio's current drug cocktail, and the first drug is midazolam. And these doctors all testified that midazolam doesn't have any analgesic properties. It doesn't have any pain-killing properties. So you can't express pain, but that doesn't mean you don't feel it. And they presented a lot of evidence that convinced the judge that you do.
Because midazolam, it's almost like a paralyzer, right? You exhibit symptoms of being numb or paralyzed, and so you can't express – like you said, you can't express it.
Yeah.
This has been an issue in Ohio for a couple of years now, with Ohio looking for different drugs to use in their executions. I believe the death row inmate was Dennis McGuire, who reports said that he writhed in pain during his execution.
It took 26 minutes. He was a guy from Preble County, mm-hmm. and that was the first time that the state had used the three-drug cocktail, and it was not pretty. It made international headlines, and Ohio ended up with a delay in executions for a while.
And that put a stop to the executions for a long period of time, more than 10 months. And so then Ohio has, again, like what Marty's been talking about, has been having trouble trying to find exactly what drugs to use, how to use it the right way. There are still lawyers who represent death row inmates who contend that, you know, even though they can't exhibit the pain that they're feeling, they are still feeling that pain.
So we just speaking of death row, we did a story last week about this guy who's been on death row for a long time, Sam Moreland. He's been on there for 33 years, and he murdered was convicted of murdering 5 people, 2 women, 3 children, and then beating or shooting to death or shooting and leaving for dead 3 other children. It's one of the most gruesome, notorious cases in Dayton history. And for a number of bureaucratic reasons, a court order that was issued in July of 2014 to have DNA testing done on some of the crime scene items is still unfulfilled. And the latest hitch is that where they sent the crime scene items to this lab, they're not certified to upload to the federal database. And so they're like trying to schedule BCI to go out and, you know, check their quality assurance measures, et cetera. And it's just I talked to one of the survivors of this family, Tia Talbot, and she is just appalled at how long it has taken. Hmm. It's a really interesting story. And it's stunning to me that, you know, it's almost going on almost 5 years that they ordered this DNA testing to happen, and it hasn't yet.
And it's BCI is in charge of that?
Yeah. What happened is they sent it to they did the order in July of 2014, and then for some reason I was doing some sort of death row issue, and I was wondering whether or not Sam Moreland was the longest serving guy. He's not. But then it made me kind of think, well, what's going on with this case? And I looked it up, and I found that it had been 2.5 years, and they hadn't fulfilled the order. So we wrote a story about it, and then it took another year for them to actually tell the evidence room, hey, get that stuff, send it to this lab. They sent it to a lab in Fairfield, Ohio. And, you know, a year later, I'm thinking, I wonder what's going on with that case. I look it up again, and it's still pending. And now the Attorney General's office is trying to find out what's going on. And it's just this, you know, it's an example of how death penalty cases can drag on and on and on. And it's difficult for the families of survivors, the survivors of these crimes, to keep, you know, having it looming over them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I have real questions now. I'd say that the future of the death penalty in Ohio is uncertain. Because of this litigation in Dayton, that prompted the governor to postpone an upcoming execution was supposed to happen on February 13th. And with these other complications, getting these drugs and all of that, I wonder how many more of these we're going to have.
It used to be that the inmate had a choice to go by either lethal injection or by electric chair.
Yeah.
And then there was one of the inmates was like, I'm going to go by the electric chair. If you're, you know, I'm going to prove that this is a nasty process. And then the lawmakers moved like super fast to like take that choice away. That was like 10 or 12 years ago.
Yeah, not long.
And again, with the question of what drugs to use and how to go about it, I mean, we've talked to lawmakers about this several times. There is an issue where can you conceal what drugs you're using so then the drug companies don't have to worry about getting bad press about it, bad publicity. One lawmaker even suggested, well, you know, he believed that the state needed to continue carrying out executions and that maybe the state needed to start looking back at other ways of doing things. And he mentioned firing squads. He mentioned also bringing back the electric chair.
Well,
and
not
he
just
said,
any lawmaker, right?
Well, I believe it was Keith Faber, the former Senate president, who said, well, maybe we just need to start looking into other measures if we're going to keep going down this road of questioning executions. And he said that he had talked to people about the use of heroin and more specifically fentanyl. So, I mean, there are people who have been looking at this issue wanting to continue executions and wanting to figure out other ways of doing it.
It's been an issue for a very, very long time in the state of Ohio. Some states have abolished the death penalty in recent years, Illinois to wit, I think, because it's – well, I mean, a lot of people oppose it for a lot of reasons, but it does cost a lot of money.
Costs a lot of money. And I think, you know, public attitudes are changing toward it.
Again.
Yeah, again. And the federal judiciary has opened up the reasons by which you can get a habeas corpus hearing as well. So there are more legal defenses for people who can argue what they call actual innocence, basically saying I didn't do it. And this, of course, is in the context of 160 some people now have walked off of death row having been proven innocent. And then back to these issues getting drugs. We've seen a big decrease in the number of people getting executed or even sentenced to the death penalty.
I wanted to talk about a commission that a lot of people don't talk about because it's complicated. And I know, Laura, you wrote about that Governor DeWine is going to name a new commissioner to the powerful Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. It affects everything that every Ohioan. Mm-hmm. It's one of those pocketbook commissions that is often ignored. So mm-hmm. Tell us what's going on. And
The PUCO is a five-member board. They serve on rotating five-year terms. There's a nominating committee, a nominating council of like 12 people, and they present a list of four names to the governor from which to choose the new commissioner. So DeWine got his list of four on Friday. Gene Krebs, former chairman mm-hmm. of the Ohio Consumers Council, is on there. And then Sam Randazzo, who's a longtime utility lawyer, is kind of anti-renewable energies and has represented the industrial energy users of Ohio. You know, we'll see. The job is to regulate electricity, natural gas, telecommunications, railroads, and I think
phone lines,
and then also trucking.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So it's a pocketbook kind of place.
When you're talking about telephone and electricity.
Yeah, people might hear Public Utilities Commission of Ohio and maybe glaze over, but you know, most people out there are paying electric bills, paying phone bills, paying something that, that the PUCO regulates. The interesting thing here is that there's been an argument in the past that there aren't enough people on the commission who represent consumer interests.
Because since the Consumer Council has been pretty much completely I shouldn't say completely, but it used to be somewhat of a powerful position.
It's been weakened in recent years.
Yeah, during the Kasich administration.
And so there's this idea. And I think there's a lot of groups, a lot of pro-environmental, pro-renewable energy groups who are opposing Sam Randazzo, especially. Sam, somebody who has represented, like Laura said, the industrial energy users of Ohio. These are groups that, you know, are against further regulations when it comes to mandating the use of renewable energy or mandating efficient energy.
And you know, what was interesting on Friday with the Q&A with Speaker Householder is he indicated that he has he thinks he's open to the idea of supporting or giving a bailout for First Energy Solutions nuclear power plants. These, without a bailout, they're likely to close in 2020. And, you know, I think previous legislation was all about putting a rider on First Energy territory customers. But the speaker indicated that he thinks that these plants benefit the entire state. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be interesting to see what kind of legislation comes forward on that.
The other argument here is that nuclear power is a zero carbon emission emitting facility. I mean, there's other waste to be handled. But he's right. I mean, if you look at the PJM stats, you know, that's the grid, the energy grid, putting out all the – during these cold winter days, nuclear power has made up about 25% of the grid. So it has helped in powering homes and keeping the heat running. So there is an argument to be made there. The weird issue that comes up, though, is that Republicans have been fighting the renewable energy mandates, these – What end up becoming subsidies or ways to
like benchmarks, right?
Yeah, benchmarks and ways to boost up the use of renewable energy. Mm-hmm. The same people who are fighting against that are fighting for what becomes a subsidy for nuclear power.
Are you suggesting that they're talking out of both sides of their mouth?
And so the issue here, and I think that Householder was trying to allude to this, but it remains to be seen what happens, is that politicians keep talking about an all-of-the-above approach to be able to take advantage of the use of all the gas that Ohio has, to take advantage of the coal that's remaining under existing regulations, and then take advantage of the nuclear, and then bring in what could be a huge industry in Ohio, which is the wind and the solar industry. And that's, you know, not to go down another path, but that's something that's being discussed at the PUCO right now, is a big wind and solar project by
AEP program down in Appalachia, right?
Yeah, in Highland County.
Highland County, right.
So another pocketbook issue that's going to come up is the gas tax.
Yeah.
The transportation budget will be coming out late February.
Before the general.
Before the operating budget comes out. And you know, Ohio's gas tax is at 28 cents a gallon. It's below all of our neighboring states except for Kentucky.
It's been since 2005
was the last increase to it. And, you know, a lot of the county engineers and the rest of them say, like, the you know, purchase power of that gas tax has really been eroded by inflation over the last 14 years. And there's a group called Fix Our Roads Now Ohio or something like that. And there it's a broad coalition, and they've been, I think they're, what they're doing is laying the groundwork, the political groundwork for the DeWine administration to say yes to a gas tax increase. Mm-hmm. That's just my thought.
And I believe if you do see a gas tax increase, you might also see a fee on the use of
electric
vehicles as well.
Another thing that's eroded gas tax revenues all over the country is more fuel-efficient vehicles, too.
Yeah.
The money has not kept up with inflation.
And we use less gas.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
In our cars.
Although we increased the speed limit, so people, you know, they're blowing down the highway and you get worse gas mileage at going 80 than you would going 60.
I always follow the speed limit, so.
I said other people, not necessarily those of us at this table.
lots of issues coming up. A new General Assembly, a different kind of General Assembly than we've had in the past, a new governor, different kind of governor. So lots to talk about in this upcoming year. What are you guys going to be covering this week?
Well, we're continuing our long look into the pharmacy benefit management industry. That's not going
anywhere.
The
middleman, yeah.
The middleman. It seems very clear to us that both the new governor and new attorney general are looking very closely at this issue. So there are probably going to be a number of developments this year. And actually also in the legislature, looking at bringing more transparency to the market and making sure that taxpayers are getting their money's worth for their billions.
I'm sitting down with AEP to talk about their renewable energy project. The interesting thing here is technically, if you look at what they're asking of the PUCO, it's the same thing that was contested by many people when it came to boosting up the coal energy. So Are we boosting up renewable energy when we said no to boosting the coal energy?
I'm working on top secret stuff. I can't
say. we're dying to know. Okay. Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, thanks for joining us. Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio's State House News Bureau, thanks to you as well. And Marty Schladen of Columbus Dispatch, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
That's it. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.